Good morning and welcome to the Albany Report. I'm your host, former State Senator Cecilia Kacik, and we have a lot to talk about today. There's a lot that's been going on with the corruption trials taking place. I know that the Sheldon Silver trial is in the jury's hands. He's the former Speaker of the Assembly. He's still an Assembly member. But it's been fascinating to learn about the trials. Both he and former Majority Leader in the Senate, Dean Skelos, are facing corruption, fraud, bribery charges. And we'll see what the jury comes back with in Sheldon Silver's case. And even more fascinating has been the goings-on in the Dean Skelos trial. I don't know if folks have been listening to the tape-recorded phone calls between Dean Skelos and his son, Adam. But that's been fascinating because I think it really shows how Albany has been working, or certainly not for you, but clearly being taking advantage of for certain people in high political office. Also, after we talk a little bit about corruption, I have a guest in the studio with me. Roger Downs is the conservation director for the Sierra Club, and we are going to be talking about oil trains. And welcome, Roger.
It's great to be here, Cece.
So we are very excited you're here. I was hoping to have Assemblywoman Fahey come and talk about her legislation around oil trains risks, but she couldn't make it. So I'm glad you were able to step in at the last minute. And we have a lot to go over around oil trains. But first, I want to, you know, mention the corruption. So what do you think about the corruption trials? Have you been following them?
Yeah, sure. To some extent. I mean, you know, all of us that work on progressing environmental legislation in Albany are watching with great fascination. I think it was pretty incredible to hear the tapes the day the fracking decision came out, the conversation between Skelos and his son. His son stood to profit greatly if fracking went forward in terms of advancing, you know, treatment facilities and other things. And
right,
how irate they were when it happened, and just kind of the hubris involved that you know, Skelos constantly pronouncing that he controls everything.
Right.
And that he was outraged that somehow this would happen beyond his control.
But, were you surprised by anything you've heard so far?
You know, you don't want to be surprised. And yet it's shocking confirmation of what you know. And I will say, you know, that the Sierra Club, we've noticed and we've said now for quite a few years that the biggest environmental issue in New York is the toxic money in politics.
Mm.
If we can clean up how money influences, big polluters influence legislation, everything else gets a whole lot easier.
Yeah, I think clearly in when the conversation between Dean Skelos and his son about the power structure, when he was chided by his son for continuing to make a deal with Jeff Klein, who's head of the IDC, and he said, "I control everything." Mm. Dean Skelos said, "So this is just a name only, and we, because we need him in case, you know, one of our members dies." It's just incredible to have that unbridled, you know, acknowledge. Yeah, I control everything. I control every committee. What goes before the committees? What bills come to the floor? Absolutely everything. And that total power. Mm. You know, in one person's hands is not what you and I voted for.
Sure.
Clearly. But there was an interesting development in my local paper, and I wanted to share that with folks. A professor of the College of St. Rose, Bruce Roter, is starting a corruption museum. And I had an interview discussion with him last night. He couldn't come on the show. So I want to play our little tape. And that maybe this corruption museum will help shed some more light and help people understand the process and the core reasons why we have a dysfunctional government in the state of New York. So here's my interview with Professor Roter. Bruce Roter. And Bruce is a professor at Albany's College of St. Rose. And it was his idea to create a museum of political corruption in Albany, and there was an article in my local newspaper on the front page. The title is Political Corruption, Is This a Tourism Draw? So, Bruce, welcome to the Albany Report.
Thank you, Cecilia. It's a pleasure to be here.
Now, what gave you this idea to do a museum about political corruption?
Well, I'll tell you, there were a number of things that inspired me for this, but one of them was just living here in Albany and having to face the headlines seemingly day after day of one corruption scandal followed by another corruption scandal. And I was having coffee with a local politician, and we were just talking about what is it that we could be a bit more lighthearted about here in Albany. And then it struck me, we have corruption. That's what we seem to be known for. And I figured since we can't run away from it, which is impossible, we might as well use it as a resource, and let's build a museum around it. Let's make money from tourism on it, but at the same time, let's educate the public also. So on just so many levels, this seemed to be a win-win situation, and I just ran with the idea from there.
So you're serious about this?
Oh, absolutely. Of course, we just received our New York State Charter over the summer, which I think officially makes us a part of the University of New York, which just further cements our educational mission. And a few weeks ago, we received a non-for-profit 501c3 status, and that pretty much gives us the green light to go ahead and do the fundraising that we need to build this museum.
Huh. So you have a board of directors.
We have a board of trustees, absolutely, and we also have a board of advisors as well. And many of the trustees and the advisors are in the field of political history, or they are museum experts.
Who's working with you on this, then?
I've got on our advisory team. We have Zephyr Teachout, former gubernatorial candidate. We also have Kathy Burton Jones, who is now the director of museum studies at Harvard University.
Huh.
We have Susan Rose Ackerman, the distinguished professor of law from Yale University. Just an amazing, wonderful team. And I just feel so honored to be working with them. And if I do anything at all, it's just to try to put the right people in the right places and then let them do their own thing to help create this amazing museum that we're going to have.
Well, I find this fascinating. You know, I'm one who has been involved in the political arena and been involved in Albany. I was a sitting senator. I ran in a seat that was gerrymandered for my opponent. And, you know, I saw firsthand the battles that are playing in Albany. And government doesn't always work for the people because of the corruption, the cronyism, and the pay-to-play culture. How does creating a museum change the current status of the way things are? I mean, are you going to be like putting out a report card about, you know, your how you're doing on corruption and whether or not the legislature is doing the right thing?
Right. No, there are other groups that put out report cards, as you well know. But just to get back to something you already said, and that is about your experience working in the halls of the state capitol. And in our museum, we're actually going to have a lecture hall. We're going to call it Kameny Lecture Hall. Mm-hmm. And we're going to invite guest speakers to come in, and especially speakers who have had experience working at the state capitol who might have advice for a new generation of legislators as to what the climate is, what they can do, how they can avoid certain situations. So perhaps we consider this an informal invitation right now. But we're going to not focus as much on the day-to-day current affairs corruption as we are. We're going to take the longer perspective of this. That's what a museum should do.
Okay.
Corruption is not a new thing in New York. It goes back to continental days. We're going to make sure that we trace the history of corruption quite well, and we're not going to worry as much about the Sheldon Silver or Dean Skelos headlines. Those are just small blips on a much larger continuum.
Mm.
What we really need to do is we need to get at the root causes of corruption, because we don't want these headlines to continue anymore.
So it's not going to be like a, you know, baseball Hall of Fame. You're not a Hall of Fame type of entity.
Well, to tell you the truth, by popular demand, yes, we are going to have a Hall of Shame. Absolutely. We will have a Hall of Shame. But I insisted that right opposite the Hall of Shame, we also have a Hall of Honor to honor those political or civic leaders that have actually combated against corruption. We want to honor them, too.
The heroes.
We don't want this museum just to demonize people. In order to get into the Hall of Shame, first of all, the person would probably have had to have been convicted, and then there probably also has to be some degree of historical perspective involved. So in that case, I suppose it is like the Hall of Fame, because you have to wait a certain amount of years before you can get into the Baseball Hall of Fame. And I could just see some corrupt politicians being disappointed if they didn't get into our Hall of Shame on the first ballot.
Well, I think you have many opportunities to recognize people who've already been, who are already in jail and served in our legislature. It's pretty sad that we've had so many people, you know, once become public servants and now are serving time.
What is it? I think it's about 30 in the past 15 years, something like that.
Yeah.
And right, it is. And so what is it? I can't imagine that these officials came to Albany saying, I'm going to be corrupt. I'm going to be corrupt. This is what I'm going to do. There was something that happened along the way, and that's what we need to focus on. And that's what we need to change. We need to change whatever the temptations are, whatever the culture is, that tempts some of our finest political leaders in this way. And that's not to say that everybody is tempted or everybody succumbs. But we can do a better job in Albany. And it's not just up to our political leaders. It's up to the public, too. And, again, that's another reason why I want to take the lead and create this museum.
So some of the issues I imagine you'll be talking about or having speakers about is the lack of voter participation, gerrymandering districts, issues that we campaign finance reform issues, that where there is legislation, there are things the legislature and governor could do to change things, and you would potentially have speakers to talk about those issues?
Oh, absolutely. Of course we will. Not just speakers. We will make sure that we'll have displays, perhaps even interactive displays, where people can try to gerrymander their own districts if they like to see what they would look like. Why not a computer's display? How would you redraw the district lines? So there are lots of possibilities here. But corruption can be a very complex issue, and if we want to do anything in this museum, we want to be able to communicate it in a way that everybody understands. We even want to have school kids on trips come to this museum and learn about their government and what can make their government work better for them.
I think that would be fascinating, to come to Albany and walk the halls of the Capitol, and then where's your museum going to be? Go down the hill and visit the cronyism cafe.
Right. The Cozy Crony Cafe, absolutely. And that's where you can order, if you're hungry, you can order the Moreland Knish, which we say it's delish, but when it's half done, we take it away.
And your museum will be focusing on New York State corruption or elsewhere in the country as well?
Well, no, it'll be focusing on New York State corruption. I think that's plenty, don't you?
Yeah, absolutely. I think you got plenty to work with right here.
We will have a space for... We will have a space for corruption outside of our borders as well.
And when do you? I know you have your not for profit is up and running. You have a board, and do you have staff yet?
No, we don't have hired staff yet. I think that will be one of our first tasks once the funding starts coming in. We will identify an executive director for the museum, and we will establish a professional fundraising team if necessary. We want to make sure we have all the right people in place to make sure this thing is a success.
Well, I am very excited about this. When do you envision having a functioning entity that people can come and visit and take a look at. Because I think when you can visualize and see things, it has a great impact on folks.
Exactly. Well, we're hoping that the full museum will be open by 2019. We're thinking of having a scaled-down version of the museum probably within a couple of years. And even before that, we would like to revamp our website so that it more resembles a virtual tour of what the museum can be.
Right.
So we're proceeding in stages with this.
Well, terrific. Well, we wish you all the best. If anyone wants to find out more about the museum and your work and maybe support your efforts, how do they get in touch with you?
Well, thanks for asking. I would encourage all of your listeners to visit our website. It's www.museumofpoliticalcorruption.org. And if they want, they can donate there. They can also participate in the survey as to what they would like to even see in this museum. So we really would appreciate their feedback.
Well, excellent. I hope we can have you on maybe in the studio at a later date to give us an update on your progress.
I'd love to.
Great. Well, Bruce Roeder, professor at Albany's College of St. Rose and visionary for the Political Corruption Museum in Albany, thank you so much for joining us today.
It's been my pleasure.
Well, tell your teachers to plan ahead, and kids, you can get a field trip to the Museum of Political Corruption in hopefully just a few short years when it's up and running. That was a fun interview, and people are so frustrated that we'll try anything to get attention paid to this. And I think it really matters what the public has to say and how the public gets involved. And this is one way to get the public engaged and give them information in. And hopefully the legislators and governor will be taking note. So we're going to switch gears and talk about oil trains with my guest, Roger Downs, who is the conservation director for the Sierra Club. And just tell us a little bit about the Sierra Club and what you guys have been doing about oil trains. And then we're going to have you introduce a op doc, which is a new thing that I want to walk our listeners through.
Sure. So basically, I mean, if listeners will think back even 4 years ago, we never saw those black tanker cars on our rails, and in 2008 there were 10,000 oil cars nationally that were shipping crude oil. Today there are over 500,000 on America's railroad tracks, and if we look at the big oil boom in North Dakota, a quarter of all that is coming through New York from Buffalo to Albany and from Canada down to Albany, and then some of it's getting on barges. And the rest is going down the Hudson Valley to refineries in New Jersey and Philadelphia. And there have been some pretty cataclysmic explosions with these things. Maybe we should start with this mini documentary that was filmed and released this spring as part of a New York Times series.
Yes, it's called A Danger on the Rails. And so the New York Times did this documentary as an op-ed kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why it's called an op-doc. And we'll link the tape to our the Albany Report Facebook page so you can take a look at it. And Roger and I will talk through it so that there are some parts where it's silence. And it's only about 5 minutes. So let's listen to A Danger on the Rails. And it's starring you.
I have a small part in it. But this is a really nicely filmed piece by John Bauermaster, who's done quite a bit for National Geographic and has a wonderful series on the Hudson River. So here we go.
So we're seeing scenes along the Hudson, and we're like actually on a boat.
Sort of ironic. It's a piece about trains, but it's all filmed from the water on a boat. So
I'm not hearing the sound. There you are talking.
It's all right. We'll have to start it again. North Dakota, and is coming by rail. So that's almost 3 billion gallons of oil a year.
Right,
virtual pipelines
on rail. Over. We're going to restart that from the beginning. We had a little technical difficulty. This is why they don't let me touch the boards. Or actually, I don't touch the boards. Okay, here we go. We're on the boat, going up the Hudson River.
The transport of petroleum products up and down the river to the Port of Albany is not new. I mean, we've been doing that for the better part of 100 years. What is new is that this is a crude product that isn't part of a local economic consumption pattern. This is Bakken crude that is coming from South Dakota, North Dakota, and is coming by rail. So that's almost 3 billion gallons of oil a year. Virtual pipelines, pipelines on rail. Hmm. Bakken crude is different from other crude oil. It has a flash point less than 74 degrees. It's shipped in these containers called DOT 111s. It is a containment unit meant for liquids, not necessarily hazardous materials.
The Transportation Safety Board has said 85% of these cars should not be handling this sort of petroleum. 120 cars on some of these trains, 30,000 gallons of fuel per car, very volatile fuel. When it comes down to it, each of these train cars is like a rolling bomb.
That's Paul Galley speaking.
From Riverkeeper, yeah. So they're showing trains going through Kingston and other Hudson Valley cities.
This is the greatest threat to the Hudson I've experienced in my entire career. These trains that run for almost 50 miles right next to the river, carrying highly explosive crude oil in rail cars that were not designed for this, that shear on impact.
That was Ned Sullivan.
The worst case scenario is that these bomb trains could come off the rails. They could explode in a Hudson River town, and there could be dramatic loss of life.
And
we've seen some cataclysmic accidents. Lac Megantic certainly is the poster child for this.
And then the video shows scenes of...
This is a derailment that killed 47 people and leveled a town.
The risk associated with the crude oil trains is manyfold. We could draw the short straw next.
That was Paul Galley again. Now that's showing pictures of train derailments and obvious disaster zones where they've derailed and fires in some cases, ending up in rivers. And it lists all the locations like Galena, Illinois, Ontario.
There have been 14 major derailments.
You're talking about the city of Albany, where you've got 100,000 people living. Something like Lac Megantic happened here. I mean, we've got the state capitol. We've got major hospitals and government buildings very close to these railroad tracks. It could be quite significant.
Around 500,000 rail cars filled with crude oil are transported to refineries around the country. Tracks pass within 5 miles of Manhattan. And then they show tracks going through New Jersey.
But if they go into the river, this is a very difficult crude to clean up.
This has been allowed to occur without having in place the kinds of regulatory constraints, without having spill response plans in place, without having equipment pre-deployed to protect our sensitive resources here in the Hudson Valley. They're not ready for this. They're not ready.
We are just collateral damage between point A and point B. We don't see any economic revenue from this. The state and the governor have argued we can't do anything about it. Railroad law trumps everything else.
There's no benefit. It's passing right through. All we're getting here is the risk, and the risk could be catastrophic.
And that was Ned Sullivan. Where is Ned from?
Ned is the executive director of Scenic Hudson.
Okay. And it that's how it ends, and it lists some recommendations by advocates. And there's the train noise. This was directed by John Bauermeister.
John Bauermeister, yeah.
And he works for the National Geographic, right?
He does, yeah, and he has a really great website right now where he's looking at several different Hudson River issues and has put it together really beautifully. So I encourage folks to go check out his site.
Yeah, it's a very well done documentary about the Hudson River and the risk. And Ned Sullivan, it says at the end, there's no benefit to us. We're just taking the risk.
Right.
And those scenes going through Kingston, you know, rail car after rail car of these very volatile oil trains, potentially hazardous, because all I'm thinking is they're on the same tracks. And we've had a huge development of the number of cars on the tracks with this heavy crude oil. We haven't changed the tracks.
We haven't.
And, you know, when you think about when these rails were built, you know, we have buildings, you know, so close to the rail in these small communities like Kingston, like right here at Hudson. We have a rail line right behind our building here at the studio in Hudson. And when the train comes through, the building shakes. I feel like I could reach my hand out the window. So we have these small rural villages and towns are right up next to the tracks.
And I think what a lot of municipal leaders and all the way up to the governor are struggling with is that, 19th century federal railroad law makes the railroads incredibly powerful, and there's a lot of preemption. It's very difficult to one, stop these trains or to enforce the kinds of sort of self-regulations that they have. They really, in some ways, have tremendous autonomy and preemption. And so what we're looking at is how do we protect our communities when mayors are told that, they can't do anything by the railroad companies themselves, and the railroad companies do not seem to be really addressing these issues. Pat Fahey was supposed to be on the program today, and I know she couldn't make it, but she has introduced legislation that is tremendously important. This is legislation that has passed the Assembly 2 years in a row and has gotten no traction in the Senate, partially because of Dean Skelos. Now it is up to John Flanagan. But basically, this legislation would require that anyone who has who stores crude oil, this is where the state does have some authority. They may not have the authority on the trains, but they have authority over crude oil storage. And we know that the oil companies all, at least at one point or another, store crude oil in New York in the transloading facilities. They have to demonstrate a surety. They have to demonstrate that if a disaster were to happen, like Lac-Mégantic, where 47 people were killed and a town was leveled, the costs right now are about $2 billion. They have to demonstrate that they have enough insurance to cover that kind of catastrophe. Essentially, we don't believe that there is an insurance carrier that could handle that.
So that her legislation says that those oil companies or whoever's transporting the oil have to assume the risk.
They have to assume the risk.
Any accidents, right, or derailments that cause damage.
Now, I hope your listeners' gut instinct is, we're less concerned about that. We want to stop accidents from happening. I mean, it is nice to make sure that there's someone to pay for catastrophic loss, but it's too late. This doesn't interest us as much as stopping it. And I will say that the people that oil companies are more afraid of, they're not afraid of regulators. They're afraid of those that insure them. And that if they have to pay a premium or actually find someone who will insure them, you know those insurance companies are going to say, no way. Not unless you do X, Y, and Z. You're going to have to slow down. You're going to have to completely change infrastructure. You're going to have to change the makeup of the tanks. You're going to have to change up the makeup of the material you're shipping. This is highly explosive, and there are things that they can do at the wellhead that can reduce the amount of volatiles.
Well, it creates an economic incentive to make sure you're transporting that oil as safely as possible.
Absolutely. And I mean, ultimately, all of us want to see these things off the rail. And I think we've all concluded that there is no safe way to transport this oil by rail.
I mean, this is a great idea. Where did this idea come from? Well, are they doing it in other states?
In California, they've played around with surety, and it's in its infancy in terms of implementation. But, you know, we've certainly looked at this issue with other things and look at car insurance. I mean, this was sort of a novel notion when it started, but a necessary one. And, you know, it's not perfect, but at least, you know, we have avoided certain catastrophes because insurance companies are held liable. And so you have better safety standards in cars.
Well, I'm just surprised that the Senate has not taken it up because you have so many businesses where their livelihood is dependent on, you know, where they're working, and they're working along the rails.
Right.
And if there's a derailment or an accident that impacts their work, that's impacting the local economy as well. It's
right.
Not just, you know, people who happen to live, but there are businesses who work along the tracks that would be impacted
right.
as well. So this, to me, protects the local economy and gives people assurance that, yeah, I will, you know, set up shop here, even though the rail is so close. And because, you know, there's a lot of safety mechanisms in place.
Right. Well, this is probably where we get this intersection again with money and politics, and that we know that the oil and gas industry has been certainly very generous with the Senate Majority Leader and other Republicans in power right now.
We haven't
been able to get a single Republican co-sponsor on this bill.
So no senators have taken up this legislation at all?
Oh, no, plenty. I mean, Tony Avella, who is an IDC member, is the sponsor in the Senate. And we have the entire Democratic conference very vocal about getting this passed.
But no Republicans.
No Republicans. And George Amador, who sees a significant portion. You know George Amador,
of
don't
course.
You?
Of course. He represents the 46th Senate District, an area that has many small towns and villages where rails go through
right.
his district.
And some of the weakest infrastructure, some of the most crumbling bridges that, you know, we've been very lucky in New York. We've had several derailments. We haven't had explosions or spills result from those derailments. But it is a matter of time. And we have some incredibly large and crumbling and dangerous bridges in his district in the Hudson Valley that we're very concerned about. And we are trying to find ways to use perhaps some local powers to get the railroad to at least address the issue.
And on this side of the river here in Hudson, we have Senator Marchione. There's been no interest in her.
So far, no. But, you know, I'm hoping that we can get this bill through the Assembly very early this year. And I'm hoping that we can get some interest from our local representatives.
So it's
local
not
senators.
Just I know we talked about the control at the top by the leaders of the Senate and the Assembly who control legislation. But you really the legislators, the individual legislators have a lot to say as well and can push those leaders to get bills through. So I would suggest that it definitely worth talking to your local senator and assembly member about this legislation.
Absolutely.
Especially when it comes up next session. Session
right.
is just around the corner.
And if you look at the vote in the Assembly, you know, we still have a mixed assembly. Certainly it is dominated by Democrats, but there are a few votes against it. It's non-controversial when it gets to the floor.
It passed this year. And so when session comes up again, does it have to be reintroduced? Will it get a new number?
It does not get a new number. This is the second year of the cycle, so it should pop right out onto the, it should be available for a floor vote.
Okay. Do you have a number handy?
You know, I should have come with the number handy, but It is certainly something that if you look at on Pat Fahey's website, or you type in the words oil trains onto the Assembly bill search, you will immediately find it.
Okay, so sending a letter to the Assemblywoman and or your local Assembly member, urging
that would be very helpful,
and doing the same in the Senate.
Even calling your local senator, your senator, and saying, I'm really concerned about this issue and I want you to take action would be incredibly helpful.
That's great advice. So you mentioned crumbling bridges. I know there was a report out recently that highlighted some deterioration in bridges and infrastructure in New York State that had to do with the rails. And you mentioned infrastructure. What's happening around infrastructure specifically?
Well, you know, I think so. The report was put out by Forest Ethics, the Waterkeeper Alliance, and the Riverkeeper Network, and it's really, it is such a mind-blowing study. Basically, they looked at, there are 10,000, more than 10,000 bridges and causeways for these tracks nationally. In New York, we have 3,000 rail bridges.
We have a lot of water.
And we have a lot of water. And they looked at 250 of them and found that a little less than half of them were completely corroding and incredibly dangerous. They found that some of them had wooden members. I mean, most of these are early 20th century construction that have not been upgraded since, but pilings that support them have are eroding at the water level. They find missing bolts. You can visibly pull rust off them with your hands. And they sort of did an investigation into, well, who monitors these?
Right. I was going to say, who's in charge of inspecting these bridges?
And the Federal Railroad Administration essentially looks to the railroads to self-monitor. And once a year, the railroad companies send them a letter, and we've seen these letters that say one page certifies the safety of all, say in New York, all 3,000 bridges are safe. And they have their own apparently inspection system, but it's not transparent to the public.
Is
it? 2008, there were some reforms that were set, but we essentially have one auditor from the Federal Railroad Administration in New York, and he covers 13 other states as well. And he's got to look at all 3,000 bridges. And I believe in the past 5 years, he is, I think, proudly proclaimed that he's looked at about 150 of them. But ultimately, there are no standards for engineering, for weight class. This is all internal to the railroads themselves.
And this has not been, I mean, so this is regulated on a federal level, and it has not been updated and modified to deal with the what we see now, which is the volume and weight on the tracks.
Absolutely. And if you look at these, you know, the recent examples of where the train, you know, a rather modern, you know, the train with all the regulatory fixes on it, you know, all the extra enhancements to protect the tank car, the one that went off in Lynchburg, Virginia. I mean, that was track failure. Galena, Illinois. Also, you know, harmful track problems. And we've seen several bridge derailments that could have been catastrophic, but you end up with a rail car just sort of hanging over the water. And I think that something needs to get done. Governor Cuomo has instituted a program of doing what he calls inspection blitzes, and we'll see every few months. The state DOT that has some delegated authority for inspection will go and look at an oil train and find defects on brakes, or look at a 7-mile stretch of track and find sort of defective ties or other things in order that they get fixed. What these guys really need to do is start looking at our bridges. I mean, you look at the one that goes over Catskill Creek. I mean, it is several hundred feet long and at least 75 feet tall, and it's just towering over the town. You can look at the pilings under it, and they are eroding. Kingston is even worse. And if any of those trains get into Catskill Creek or the Rondout or any number of tributaries in the Hudson, we will have a massive problem.
So what happens if a train does hit the water and ruptures? Maybe there's a fire, maybe there's not. But what happens? The oil just sinks.
Right. Well, I mean, there are two scenarios. If there is a fire, it is recommended that, I mean, the blast zone is a mile wide, and that the recommendation is evacuate. Firefighters, emergency responders are told, don't go towards the fire. Get everyone away from it. Let it burn out.
Because you're not going to be able to put it out.
That's right. And if you look at the railroad network across the United States where these trains go, that's 25 million people live within 1 mile of these tracks. So say there isn't a fire, and then there's just a massive spill. We know that Bakken crude is incredibly difficult to clean up, or if it's dilbit, which is sort of a diluted tar sands oil, which it could be as well. And basically it sinks into the water column and it disperses rapidly. There was a spill of this in the Mississippi last year, maybe 18 months ago, They lost 36,000 gallons, and they were able to recover 95 gallons.
Wow.
95 gallons of 36,000 gallons of oil spilled. And it is so diffuse, and it immediately permeates the entire water column. It'll be almost impossible to clean up. And the Hudson is an incredibly important estuary for Atlantic fisheries. It is a heritage river. It is struggling right now, as all rivers are with climate change. I don't think it could recover from a massive spill like that.
So what is the citizen to do? Like if people who see something that concerns them, piling that looks like it's deteriorating and they're worried, and they know oil trains are going over that bridge.
Sure.
What do they do?
Well, I think for one, it's important for all of us to get more involved. I think that we have to start taking pictures of these things and sending it to the Federal Railroad Administration, but also to the governor. I mean, I think that Andrew Cuomo has done quite a bit within the realm of you know, preemption, what we've sort of staked out. But I think he's got to push the envelope a little bit more. Mm-hmm. And I think we need to see some aggressive leadership here in protecting New Yorkers. But I think that on the community level, a lot of folks have felt kind of helpless. And we all have been looking to Albany because that is the hub right now. This is where oil is unloaded onto barges. And now there's a proposal to build a pipeline to unload at the Port of Albany that will follow the thruway we can talk about in a little bit. I think that we need to push our state lawmakers to restrict everything going through Albany. We can really choke off this oil in Albany using state authority. Mm-hmm. And I think that Cuomo should be pushed to do more in that.
Right. And your local legislators can be called and asked to come and see the concern that you have. And they can help raise the awareness and raise attention to these issues, and they can push the governor.
Absolutely.
And those legislative leaders that have so much power can use it for public good too,
right?
Not just, you know, self-aggrandizement. So make your legislators work is what I would say, and bug them. Things don't happen because they should. Things happen because people make them happen, and it can be very, you know, you've got to be very persistent. And don't take no for an answer. And you know, maybe your phone call doesn't end in a response. Well, maybe your neighbors need to call too, and other people need to call. And if you get enough phone calls, they'll show up.
Absolutely.
And they will definitely get involved. But if they don't hear from you, they don't think it's a problem. And if we, the people, don't think it's a problem, it will not get addressed. And there's certainly a lot of concerns around the whole infrastructure around oil trains. They're not going away anytime soon. And, you know, they're, as Ned Sullivan said on the documentary tape, we're assuming all the risk.
That's
and
right.
We have none of the benefits, and we are not prepared.
Right.
And we've got to make sure our government has us on their radar and is doing everything we can to prevent and prepare for the inevitable problems that will occur because our infrastructure is so old and in need of improvement.
That's right. That's right.
So you mentioned the Pilgrim Pipeline. How does the pipeline fit into this?
Well, this is a fascinating and I still unbelievable to me development. I mean, we've stopped the Keystone XL pipeline going through the Midwest, and yet there is a very hardened proposal now to bring a similar pipeline from the Port of Albany along the thruway right-of-way, so right along where we drive all the way south to Linden, New Jersey. So it's 170 miles of a twin pipeline. So basically these trains would come. It would increase crude by rail to the Port of Albany. They would unload into this pipeline. It would follow the route of the thruway. And at a refinery, the Phillips 66 refinery in New Jersey, they would then produce various gasolines, home heating oils, kerosene, and then it would go into a second parallel pipeline that would then come back up to the Port of Albany.
Wow.
So we've got, you know, two 20-inch pipelines that if are anything like some of the other Enbridge pipelines that have been constructed in the past 10 years, have a good possibility of rupturing. We saw in the Kalamazoo River, almost 1 million gallons of dilbit. This is tar sands crude spill out of that pipeline. It was slightly bigger than this proposed one. It caused a little more than $1 billion worth of damage, contaminated 70 miles of the Kalamazoo River. And that river will never be the same. They did the best cleanup they could, but it is forever harmed. We've seen neighborhoods flooded in Mayflower, Arkansas, another pipeline, an Enbridge pipeline.
Flooded with the oil?
Flooded with oil. You see these beautiful suburban houses just soaked in oil and, just rolling through these sort of bucolic...
But Roger, I hear people say pipelines are safer than trains. So if you don't want it on the rails, isn't a pipeline safer to travel through?
That's the argument they're given. And one, I don't think it's actually true.
Will it reduce the train traffic?
It won't. The argument they're giving, of course, is that, well, we're going to be displacing trains. We're going to be displacing barges by having it go through a pipeline. There's no guarantee, and we know that the way the market is working now, they desperately want to get as much oil as they can from North Dakota to the refineries. And so it will only be addition. It's not going to be subtraction. It will be all the trains on the rails, all the barges on the river, and now we have a new conduit, the pipeline.
You don't see it having any direct correlation on reducing train traffic?
I think, if anything, it will solidify the need for trains once you build that pipeline.
To move that pipeline oil.
Exactly, because then the pipeline will be obsolete if you get rid of trains.
So it goes down to Lindenhurst for refinery, comes back up refined, and then where's it go? It comes back up to Albany?
It comes back to Albany, and then Albany becomes a distribution hub. So it can be loaded onto trucks. It can
barges
on barges and
going down
other
the Hudson
places.
River,
right? But it, you know, what's really interesting also is that they filed 4 months ago the
Who's
Thruway
they?
Authority. Sorry, Pilgrim Pipeline Company, which is a subsidiary owned by the Koch brothers. So this is the worst climate change deniers, biggest political operatives. When you talk about money and politics, these are the poster children. And basically, the Thruway Authority has been sitting on it for 4 months. They sent a letter last week to DEC saying, we're going to be lead agency here for the environmental review.
The Thruway Authority?
So the Thruway Authority is going to be lead agency unless, before the 16th, enough members of the public and other involved agencies write them a letter and say, what are you, nuts? You know, and I think, you know, how should the Thruway Authority be the lead agency?
How is the Thruway Authority ever?
Well, I mean, for one, they're not very transparent.
No.
Secondly, they are the only agency in all this that can actually gain economically from this. If they give their right of way, they ultimately will be getting money for this. So right now we are campaigning very hard to have members of the public reach out to Governor Cuomo. And I've got this. And basically, the message is the Thruway Authority should not be the lead agency, should not be the agency in charge of seeing if this is an environmentally responsible project. Because
right. It's just bizarre. I mean, you don't have public hearings. You don't elect people to represent you. There's no, I would say, public voice at the Thruway Authority. I mean, it's very top-down controlled. The governor puts in people.
And they don't have an environmental expertise. What we really want is the Department of Environmental Conservation to take over lead agency status.
And what is DEC saying about that?
Well, I think that they issued a statement certainly saying that they would be involved.
What does that mean?
I know internally DEC is, you know, has constantly slashed budgets. They're understaffed.
Right.
This is a huge headache for them. And I think a lot of folks in state government really can't believe this is such an outrageously inappropriate proposal.
So what is the public process?
Well, it's also odd because usually it starts out with the filling out of an environmental assessment form.
Okay.
It's 7 pages, and then there's a determination who's the lead agency. In this case, the pipeline company has put together several thousand pages of an environmental impact statement and has sort of declared that process is over and that they're ready to move forward. you know, it usually starts slow, and then there's public scoping, there's public hearings, the public provides input. Then they write the EIS, and it's almost like they're trying to mimic a legitimate environmental review process. And the odd thing here is every major energy proposal in New York has a siting process. For power plants, you have Article 10. Mm-hmm. For pipelines of gas, you either have the PSC or you have the FERC, the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, and there's an entirely established environmental proposal. We've never had an oil pipeline, and so there's no agency that automatically can claim jurisdiction, and there's no agency that has an established process. So we're kind of in a wild west here. Wow. Which makes it all the more reason, it's all the more reason why the Thruway Authority really is the wrong agency here. So they have until December 16th to make that final determination. We'd love it if people would call Governor Cuomo, so you can call at 518-474-8390. And demand that the Thruway Authority is the inappropriate lead agency, and the DEC should be the lead agency to oversee the environmental review for the Pilgrim pipelines.
And the governor can make a decision to say it's not the Thruway Authority, it's DEC. The governor can weigh in on this. Obviously.
The governor can pick up the phone and make the call, and yeah. And that will happen. Yes.
Yeah. So I'm going to put that on my Christmas list. Those things that I would like for, you know, Christmas, and for folks who don't celebrate Christmas, Hanukkah, or whatever. This is something that is good for the public.
And, right.
You know, I really appreciate your sharing this with us, because I had no idea this. It was the Thruway Authority was the main applicant.
And one thing that's important, too, is that other named agencies are also the communities that are along the Thruway that this will go through. So it's, you know, in Albany County, Greene County, Ulster and Orange.
So wherever the Thruway is, these two pipes will be.
That's right. So if you happen to live in one of those towns, contact your local town board because they have actually a lot of sway here. And if we can get... So town of New Paltz has already issued a letter to the Thruway Authority demanding that they be made lead agency. The town of New Paltz would rather be lead agency and take on this environmental review process than have the Thruway do it. And in a de facto sense, they said we would welcome the DEC being lead agency, but we will assume that responsibility over having you do it. It's so inappropriate. Wow. So we're encouraging other townships to take the same action.
And I think it's also another example of where you can talk to your state representative in the Assembly and the Senate. They should be writing letters too.
Absolutely.
And putting pressure on the governor's office to put the DEC in charge instead of the Thruway Authority. I mean, it doesn't make any sense, because the Thruway Authority would benefit financially from this. They should not be doing the environmental review process.
And I think the Thruway Authority also has a responsibility to really look at this as a valuable public corridor. I mean, they should be seeing this as, if they are going to put anything down, it should have maximum public benefit. And so that means perhaps fiber optic cables or something to help with smart grids.
Hey,
to promote the
internet access in rural areas.
That's right. The flow of renewable energy to sort of adopt, you know, 19th century fuel, you know, transloading policies through the Thruway corridor. It doesn't make any sense.
Benefit for all of us. What an idea. Rather than the risk, let's get some of the benefit to
That's
New
right.
York State. Well, Roger, this has been a fascinating conversation, and I feel like I need to have you back after December the 16th.
Yeah, we'll find out what happens,
and,
right?
And we'll see what happened. And I hope our listeners call the governor and let him know, and call your state legislators about this information. We're going to end today's show, but I will be back next Monday, and we'll have a nice surprise on, because I don't know who's coming. And we're going to send the show out with Louis Armstrong and Lazy River, because I love Louis Armstrong. And thank you so much for listening, and thank you to my guests, Roger Downs and Neva, for running the boards. Thank you.
good, Trummy. Uh-huh, way down, way down, way down.
Oh, up the lazy river where the old mill run. Up the lazy river, the noonday sun. Lingering in the shade of a kind old tree.
Go away, troubles, dream a dream of me, dream a dream of me.
Up the lazy river where the robin's song, two bright lights as we stroll along. Blue skies up above, the one I love. Up the lazy river, how happy we will be, mama, yeah. Yes, I'm a lazy river, put it to this Bible. Ba 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 do 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 do
up the lazy river. Oh, you river, you river, oh, you dog river. Look out there, Billy Kyle, modulate, daddy, modulate.